Service Radio.
You're listening to The Tidbit on Full Service Radio. We are live from the Chesapeake Food Summit, and this is brought to you by Curate. I'm your host and the CEO of Curate, Kim Bryden. Do you run a small business or have dreams to start one? Well, here at The Tidbit, we've got your back. Each week, we talk through tidbits of knowledge around starting or running a small business with a food and beverage lens. What I love most about going to these conferences is that I think there's an opportunity for multiple players in the food system to convene and hopefully coincidentally connect over a theory of change. One of the panelists that I heard may have said it best. He said, oftentimes there are people who have community voice and innovations, and they are separate from those who have access to resources, capital, and ultimately political will and policy change. And those two spheres happen to interact very separately from each other most of the time. And so how can we create these spaces where the two are colliding and bumping up next to each other? And is it possible to effectuate change in that way by building these relationships between policy, advocacy, community voice, innovation, access to resources and capital? And that's what this Chesapeake Food Summit is really all about. I wanted to dive in deeper around, again, what happens when policy and community voice and government and resources bump into each other. What is possible to be done? We have the immense pleasure of sitting down with Holly Freistadt, the Baltimore Food Policy Director, to talk about her role as a food policy director and how in this position, she's been able to work with government, contracting, and procurement to effectuate change. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back with Holly. The Tidbit live at the Chesapeake Food Summit, and we are here with Holly Freistadt, the Baltimore Food Policy Director. And you just wrapped a breakout session on how large institutional food providers like schools and hospital systems have the potential to deliver sustainable, equitable, and nutritious food to underserved communities, including many neighborhoods in Baltimore. So what remain as some of the greatest challenges to these larger institutions to better serve their communities?
So I would say the first, I would say with every barrier this opportunity, mm-hmm. is how do the institutions work with city government and how do we support each other's procurement processes, right? And so one of the things that we're doing with the Baltimore Food Policy Initiative is that we're really looking at food access from multiple platforms, right? So we're looking at it from a retail perspective, from economics and jobs. We're looking at it from federal nutrition assistance programs, from summer meals to after school meals to school meals. Right? We're looking at it from transportation, all these different access points for any individual in Baltimore City or anywhere else to be able to have access to healthy, affordable food and to be able not to have it be an inconvenience as well, right?
Absolutely.
And so when you really look at it from the Baltimore perspective, is that everyone always says, you know, what are the schools doing for food? Which is great. And Baltimore City School District is doing phenomenal work. And they're moving into good food purchasing, and they're sourcing a lot of local product, a lot more fresh fruits and vegetables. And then you can say all this great work that's happening in the hospitals. And so those are the obvious players, right? But the player that no one really thinks about is what is the role of city government, right? And where do we actually interface with that? And so one of the things that I've been in this position for 8.5 years. And so naively, when I came in, I was like, oh, well, school food, right? But then I learned quickly that the school district operates their own food service and they do phenomenal work now, right? But where does, and so we don't do a lot of food, or we didn't think we did a lot of food, right? So I was trying to figure out who does what, and I went over to the purchasing and looked on procurement on our city buy, and I then realized all the procurement contracts that we have in the city that we issue. And that is where our roles and opportunities and our alignment is. So what we have found, and some of it is, you know, learning from each other, but for in Baltimore, what we really found our place is in the federal nutrition assistance programs. That we're writing and supporting those contracts and RFP processes. Mm-hmm. So that's one area that we could talk more about if that's of interest.
Yeah, and I was speaking with a different city government official on their procurement policies recently, and exactly to your point, people often forget about the city's spend in food after school programs, like you mentioned, penitentiaries, aging and healthcare systems for the elderly. And so I think there's a ton of opportunity when we look even outside of the private sector to government contracts and how are we sort of breaking them up in order to better facilitate more transparency with that purchasing power. And this is something you clearly have a lot of experience in. So what are some of those ways in which you've sort of broken up these systems?
So one thing is that we really have been fortunate to have the Center for Good Food Purchasing and other cities leading the way on how they're doing institutional purchasing or how they're looking at good food purchasing. So one is having those models have been really helpful, and we've been embedding them into how we think and write our procurement contracts in the city. So I have two main examples I wanted to share, actually three.
Oh, great.
I'll tell you what they are ahead of time, and then I'll go into more detail. One is summer meals, really looking at the hunger gap for kids. The second is seniors and their hunger gap that they have almost every day, right? And then also one is really looking at farmers and how they may have a play and role here as well. On summer meals, one of the things that we realized is that Baltimore City, you know, as you know, we have our healthy food priority areas. Mm-hmm. They used to be called food deserts. We changed the name really to look at the frame. Mm-hmm. They are not naturally occurring. Who are we kidding, right? And so we really wanted to have a name that would allow for residents to frame the issue how they would like to frame it and let the city be able to look at the policies, instruction systems to support it. But the definition never changed, just to be clear. So all the food environment mapping we're doing remains the same. The frame and the way we talk about it has changed.
And language matters.
Yeah. And you know what? 8 years ago, you know, with Let's Move and the momentum, and that cities really were not thinking about food deserts in the way that they are now, mm-hmm. and now we need to think about it, you know, and frame it differently, because some of the work remains exactly the same, the frame needs to change.
Yeah.
And so with that, though, so we're calling them healthy food priority areas. It's a mouthful, intentionally. It sounds very government-y, right? Intentionally, so that residents can talk how they want to talk about it,
right.
And then we can support it. So anyway, getting to the main point here, is that kids and seniors are disproportionately impacted. They're the ones who are most vulnerable in having access to healthy, affordable food. And so what are we going to do about it, right? And there's many ways. There's no one solution. We're just talking procurement right now.
Right.
We're not talking about all the multitude of other things we are doing in the city to support this.
Mm-hmm.
And so for summer meals, so in Baltimore, our kids get to eat 2 or 3 meals free a day. Right? We have community eligibility provision, so you can have breakfast for free, you can have lunch for free, and some schools can even have dinner for free.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's great. What happens in the summer? Right? And so we've had summer meals forever. It's not like it's a new thing. The way we do it is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have is we have 3 key sponsors in Baltimore. We have our schools who provide probably 100 to 125 summer meals,
mm-hmm.
and they already have their contracts in place. They're doing great.
With their food service contractors.
Yeah. And then we have Baltimore City, we have housing, and we have Family League and other nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the summer, how are those entities, what do our contracts look like, how is it seamless between, how do we really support and feed as many kids the best quality food possible? And the way that the city had a role in here was how we wrote the contract.
Mm-hmm.
And realized that there was a couple key things that we could do to support the quality of food. So one is that we put values into our procurement contract. Right. So first of all, it was lowest bid, and we changed it to an RFP.
Yeah.
Number one. And then when we changed it to an RFP, we have 4 key criteria. Really looking at nutrition and health and the quality of food. We're looking at where it's sourced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Maryland. Looking at waste reduction and efficiencies in the system. You know, I'm really looking at sort of a value-based system. So that's one. And what we've realized...
Just to clarify, yes. RFP is Request for Proposal. And I just want to focus on that for a moment, because I think many governmental or institutional systems do end up doing their procurement on lowest bid, which is such a disservice to so many emerging entrepreneurs, because a lot of times you can't always compete on the lowest bid, but by issuing more of an RFP, this is the problem we have, who can solve it type of mentality, that person bidding on that contract can be more explanatory about why they're the best solution for this problem. I love this.
So let me go further. So there's, I would love to say, come in with every price point, we can take the highest. Yeah. We can't, right?
Right?
But what we can say is the reason why it was relatively easy for us to change this mentality was because we're talking federal nutrition assistance programs. Mm. It's already a race to the bottom, right? The contract and the meal price point is already low. Mm. So do I really want it to go much lower, or do I want to ask the vendor, what's the very best, greatest food you can give us at this low price point, right? Rather than saying go lower and lower and lower, because then we wonder why kids or seniors are not eating the food.
Right.
So one is understanding that this was a really good template and framework when we're looking at federal nutrition assistance program, which is already a low price point.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one piece. And really seeing how do we get the most out of what we have, out of that dollar, or a few dollars, or several dollars, or it may be. And one of the things that we realized in Baltimore, just to put this into scale perspective, we have around over 600 summer meal sites, right?
600?
600 in the summer.
Wow. How many kids do they feed?
I have to tell you that number in a few
minutes. Yeah.
So a lot of kids.
Right.
Right. A lot of kids over $1 million contracts for sure, right?
Wow.
But what we realized is, here we are sitting, and you're saying, how does a small provider or vendor fit in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you used to say, well, you can't, right? Like, how we wrote the contract was, it was one vendor who supplied all the meals in the city under one contract, right, for summer meals. And so what we were able to do is say, okay, what about everybody else? Let's divide that contract out.
Mm-hmm.
So for summer meals, and for each procurement contract, it looks different. Mm-hmm. For summer meals, we said, okay, let's go into four quadrants. Let's make four different RFPs, you know, and so different vendors can apply for different components. So if you're over here and you want to be able to provide summer meals, you might be able to do 300 meals, but not 1,000 meals.
Right.
So one is how we wrote the quadrants, or broke up the RFP so different players can play. Now, switching it over to an aging contract, which just went out the RFP,
mm-hmm.
now that looks different. We couldn't do it in quadrants like summer meals, so it didn't play out that way. But we did it by meals.
Mm.
So there are some aging meals that are for weekends. So we have a weekend contract, you know, and then we have another one that's way bigger that's just for lunch. Mm-hmm. So that we're trying to break out our contracts so we have minority businesses, we have women businesses, we have small, medium businesses. Now, granted, these are still complicated big contracts. And it's not for someone who just started a business yesterday, but they may not have been here for 30 years either. And so how we put those quadrants and write the RFP does have an impact on who can even be at that table.
Yeah, and to those quadrants, it even then goes into part of your core values or philosophy of having residents have an equitable voice at the table. Because if then, perhaps, someone's bidding on this contract who is a business of that quadrant of the city, now that individual business owner is now supplying the meals to that quadrant where they've been born and raised. And so I think there's importance here of talking about the ripple effect of procurement.
Yeah.
It's not just me transacting, but that entire confidence ripple effect of seeing, wow, Joe here, he started in the community and now he's got this contract to feed all of the summer meals. Maybe I too can have this business at some point in time because I've seen them grow through this tiered procurement opportunity. So I think that's wonderful, and being able to say, how can we take what was once a behemoth of a contract and make it a little bit more approachable,
right,
for a business owner.
And so there's pros and cons.
Sure.
Yes, right? And so for small business, beginning businesses, social entrepreneurs, it is great. Minority businesses that may not have been able to have some of these other contracts now have access. Now, we also have to understand that there's big companies that have had these contracts for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that we have to remember is that the way our food supply and food system works is that the more meals you have, the lower price point you can have, and the operation of scale. So there is this balance we have to play with, mm-hmm. because we need to have both. We need those big contracts. We need those folks who can be there night and day, anytime. They have a really great, comprehensive food supply chain. Mm-hmm. But we also want to make sure there's a space for the smaller guys or mid-scale folks as well. Mm-hmm. And so right now we're talking pretty much, you still have to be, you know, very, very experienced, medium-scale, small-scale, but very experienced if we're talking about any of these federal nutrition contracts.
Right.
When we talk about agriculture and CSAs, you know, in other places, or, you know, catering contracts with cities, there might be other places for the more green businesses to have a place to play, or farmers in small scales.
Absolutely. And before we get into that, because I think CSAs, urban ag, super fascinating, but I want us to take a step back for a moment and just frame your role in the context of all of this, because we've been diving into you discussing how you as the Baltimore Food Policy Director have looked at these contracts and started breaking them apart. And I'm wondering, were you involved in establishing this role, and what are the current top priorities? And have you seen this role, because you've been in this for eight and a half years. So where did it begin? Where do you see your role growing? How much of procurement is your focus? Right. Maybe if you had a pie chart of time.
So the work that I do is successful because it changes over time. Mm-hmm. So what I was doing 8.5 years ago versus what I'm doing now and what I will be doing in the future needs to always be changing. Because what I really feel my job is to find the gaps, help fill it. And usually what it means is find the gap and then whatever those mechanisms to find the right person to fill it. So it's not about me doing everything, but it's about getting the right people in the right places so that they can really provide leadership to do the work. Mm-hmm. And that we are that holding ground. We will do the work on procurement until the opportunity arises, and that we have a procurement person, similar to how Philadelphia has a procurement person who does that full time. Mm-hmm. Right? And so it's that evolution. So when I first came in this job 8.5 years ago, there was a food policy task force recommendations. I was hired to implement a 10-point plan, which was very broad in nature. The climate then was very different than it is now. Mm-hmm. So during that time, it was a really phenomenal time to create organizational structure, right? So that is the time where I was able to take my grant-funded position that was not really in city government but looked like city government and get it to be a city position, you know, as a food policy director. And then over time, and we're talking over a 5-year incremental time frame, to be able to get more positions in. So we have a food resilience planner, we have a food access planner, all in the Office of Sustainability in the Department of Planning. We have a food retail director in the Baltimore Development Corporation who does a lot, most of the food economy, attraction, retention of food retail.
Shout out to Kristen Dawson.
Kristen Dawson, who is a superhero over there doing that component, right? And then we have over at the health department doing community-based food access programming in the Baltimore and the virtual supermarket. And then we are over at housing and Alice Kennedy and summer meals. So really over at school districts. So the point is that there are strong leads within many agencies in the city who are their own superheroes and their own superstars, you know, working together to address these issues.
And creating that connective tissue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I would say that has really been one of the key components of the work, is figuring out what is needed, what is the timing, you know, what needs, you know, it's really what needs to get fixed now, what do we need to get fixed in the future, trying to predict, which we obviously cannot, you know, what might be broken in the future, and get the right people in the right places. I would say that's really what we do. And so with food procurement, we realized that the procurement contract was coming up. This was for housing several years ago, and realized that there was an opportunity there. And then the aging contract came up, so there was opportunity there. And then we will be working on sort of the catering contract of, you know, the city agencies. And what will be really great when we're just starting that work, and it could be a couple of years while we work through this. What's amazing here is this is where the really small vendor can play. Right, we're talking about everything. It's not tons of money, but I'm talking millions of dollars, like school districts and multi-million dollars. We're talking about different departments catering meals for whether it's commissions or whether it's meetings or whether it's events, and it's multiple departments, and which vendors are applying, and is there criteria for that? You know, are there standards? You know, is it just one big, you know, compilation of vendors on CityBuy, or is there criteria associated? And so that's the piece that we're going to be working on next.
Oh, I love this. We are here with Holly Freistadt, Baltimore Food Policy Director. We are going to take a quick break and be right back. You're listening to The Tidbit. We are live at the Chesapeake Food Summit, and we are sitting here with Holly Freistadt, the Food Policy Director in Baltimore. Thanks for being here, Holly.
It's great to be here.
So our entrepreneur listeners tend to have very diverse sets of backgrounds prior to becoming business owners. And it's always interesting to hear stories about how someone's career path developed, especially when it comes to starting something that didn't previously exist, like a business, or in your case, your specific role. And so I'm really glad we just heard a little bit about the evolution of your time as the Food Policy Director. And so before we dive in deeper, again, back into food procurement in particular and how that entrepreneur could maybe get involved, I'm wondering, how did you personally come into this specialization? How did you get into this career?
So I started in college in nutrition.
Mm.
And at that time, nutrition was really about, you know, sugar was sugar. High fructose sugar, corn syrup is the same as fruit sugar, right? Obviously it's not, right? And so it just felt like the chemistry and the nutrition is one really important component, but there has to be a bigger system at play. So I farmed my way through college. I went to the University of Vermont. It wasn't very hard to farm in Vermont. Now, I farmed my way through college, spent time in Nepal learning about women in agriculture and supply chain, and realized, wait, it's not that different here in the U.S., and that doesn't really quite make sense. You know, what does our food system look like? Where is the community in it? You know, where is our regionalization and local? And so it's really been an evolution for me. At first, it was really about nutrition and science, to then agriculture and hands-on, literally getting my hands in the dirt, to nutrition curricula and writing nutrition and gardening and cooking enhanced curriculum in Washington State through extension, to actually where in this conversation I was just in, you know, working with Lopez Island on the very first USDA inspected mobile slaughter facility years ago.
Wow, that's neat.
You know, so a lot of my work has been hands-on. And I've only learned the terminology of who I am recently, which is I'm a social entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I did not know I existed until someone gave me the terminology, but I've always been in this social entrepreneur movement, this innovator, trying to look and think outside of a system, but still sort of in the social enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm called a social entrepreneur.
Amazing.
And finding really what I'm saying is I am in so many ways an activist, but I use policy as that mechanism, right? And so how do I use policy to really look policy systems, priorities, you know, to really start to move and shape a system?
Amazing. And great segue with your background of agriculture, because you did touch on CSAs in our earlier segment. And I just want to define community-supported agriculture. CSA is something that you've been closely watching in Baltimore. And so for our listeners who may not know, a CSA is a system that connects producers and consumers more closely by allowing them to share the risks of farming. So you buy into a farm for a season so that they have that stable cash flow to then give you the goods throughout that particular, harvest. And so practically speaking, it's that subscription service in which members of the community who subscribe to that producer's harvest receive that supply of produce. And so one of the pieces of your work has involved CSAs in Baltimore being covered through employee wellness programs.
Yep.
And so can you tell us a bit more about that and how you looked at food procurement in this lens of wellness?
Sure. So I want to reframe. The frame you just did is exactly right, coming from the agricultural sector, right?
Okay, yes.
All right, but now we're going to reframe this for the health sector, right?
Perfect.
So the reframe of the health sector is you have all these employees in city government or any institution, right? And how do we know, how can we support them to be healthier, right? And so in Baltimore City, we have this wellness reimbursement. And I have to put a disclaimer in here. It depends on your labor union, what the disbursement looks like, or what the wellness incentive may be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so for one of the labor unions in the city, this wellness incentive was $250. And this is around, let's go back 8 years ago. Right? 8 years ago, it was $250, and you could use it to join a gym. Right? You could use it to get your eyeglasses. It was really around the wellness. But it said on the bottom, you cannot use it for food. Because I think they did not want you to go food shopping with it, right?
Mm.
Or, you know, maybe get Weight Watchers or something of, like, just food to eat for consumption.
Right.
And so starting to learn and understand why this wellness incentive was in place, what was the limitations, what were the opportunities, it became this amazing opportunity, you know, to have CSAs be an allowable use for the wellness incentive, which it is now. So if you're a MAPS employee, you are able to, if you're a new employee, you come in, you get a little sheet that says you're a MAPS employee, you're a wellness incentive, oh, and you can join a gym, or you can join a CSA. Now, the difference between a gym and a CSA, you can sign up to go to a gym and never go. Right? And yeah, granted, you can have your produce come to your house every day and not eat it, but more likely than not, you're going to start eating it, right? Because it's there and right in front of you. And so we were able to change this memorandum agreement so that if you are a MAPS employee, you can be able to use your reimbursement for a CSA.
Mm.
And so what's been really interesting is watching how that has changed the CSA movement. Now, granted, this is not like an overhaul where every single city employee is doing this. That's not the case at all. For those who this works for, it works great. For those who it doesn't, there's other mechanisms that they're trying to support their wellness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have started to see now is that some CSAs are $600, right? And so you can take your $250 and put it towards your CSA, and it's definitely an incentive. Well, some of the farms now are doing, you know, the CSA card, where you put $250, to be precise, right? $250 minimum on your card, and then you can be able to have your CSA for the summer or for the season.
Mm.
So I have a CSA. And right now, I spent $250, thank you, my wellness reimbursement, right, for my produce. And so that has been a way that it's just one of the mechanisms. It's not the answer for everything. It was just this innovation of we already had this wellness reimbursement, and we've been trying to work with other wellness reimbursements in the city to see how that fits in. So that was a place where some farmers could really find the mechanism to access city government in a way that's more in a smaller scale perspective.
That's incredible. Are there any farms or particular CSAs that you've seen take advantage of this opportunity that we can give a little, like, props to?
So I'm actually not going to answer your question.
Oh, I can't say.
So yes. It's not because I don't have the way that we've done this, which I think is the success to it.
Oh, yeah.
Is the success is that I don't know all of them, because how it works is that if you're a city employee, you could belong to any CSA where you live, right?
Okay.
So it's not that, at first I was thinking, well, you know, we should have a few farms, and I'm trying not to name specific farms intentionally, okay?
Yeah.
is we could have a few farms up into the city that deliver the produce. But really, if this is to work, wherever people are living, wherever this is convenient to you as a city employee to access your CSA and support your local regional farms, we want you to do that.
Giving and the agency and ownership.
Right.
To
so them. How we really did it was it needed to be an approved CSA, meaning you needed to be on Maryland Best.
Mm.
Right? So if you were a CSA on Maryland Best, you would, you know, and really wanting to make sure that the farmers are telling their potential customers, hey, do you know about the city's, you know, reimbursement program? And if you are you a city employee?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're a city employee, then maybe you should look at this. Maybe you can use this wellness incentive.
Yeah.
Great,
you know, marketing and business development.
Right. And so I think that's the piece, is that we want to be able to support as many farms as possible and for employees to be able to use whatever farms are closest and most convenient to them.
Amazing. Great. And so as somebody who's worked very closely with these food providers and now also very specifically larger institutions, the city, of course, being one of them, but you also have touched on many other eds and meds in this space, are there one or two top pieces of advice you may have for an entrepreneur about how to get on these buyers' radar? I'm just starting out. What do I do to put myself out there?
Yes. So I'm going to go back to, like, procurement 101, when we issue an RFP, which you've already defined, right? And it will have this criteria for MBE and WBE requirements, mm-hmm. all right? So that's minority business enterprise and women business enterprise, MBE and WBE, right? And you have to be approved and on the list, all right? So anyone who fits under MBE and WBE requirements, one, make sure you are on that list, because then when these RFPs come out, there's requirements that you need to have X number or X amount of dollars in MBE and WBE. But what we see on this side from the city is we'll see a lot of MBE and WBE requirements on transportation, mm-hmm. on logistics. But when it comes to food, there's not that many out there.
It's true.
And so I would say is make sure that you're on the list. And if you're not on the list, learn where you need to be on the list. And to figure out how do you find the space. Because some of our greatest barriers is like, who are those minority and women business enterprises? Because once they start there, then they can become prime leader, right? And so it's a really phenomenal way to get into this market share. And that list doesn't have a ton of food vendors.
It doesn't.
It has a ton of operations and transportation and logistics mm-hmm. components. So and that would be my number one recommendation. It would be very helpful to us.
I think that is phenomenal, and I'm going to shout out to Jim at the Small Business Resource Center in Baltimore. He is the guy you should talk to if you're looking to get on the minority and women-owned business list, approved business list in Baltimore City. Any other piece of advice you may have? When you're looking at this whole contracting behemoth of a landscape.
Let's see. Are there so specifically to small businesses? You know, I think the question we really need to ask is that here we are sitting, really talking about farm to institution, right? Making this assumption that these really, you know, small startup businesses belong in institutional market shares, mm. right? I would say, yes, it's a phenomenal opportunity at certain times in your business when you're of scale, when you have the logistics, when you have when it's no longer about the details of the day-to-day and making it through the day, when you're actually thinking and planning for weeks and months and years ahead and forecasting, then you might be at that place. But I think don't always assume that the institutional market share is your place. It may be, and it's a phenomenal place. But there are, because from the procurement side, the requirements we have on the federal nutrition assistance, we have federal requirements, we have state requirements, we have city requirements, we have like times, you have to be within a 5-minute time frame or a half an hour time frame. And so I think it's a question of making sure you really know what your market share is. If you belong in the institutional share, what size? Is it the whole school district? Is it the whole city? Is it a quadrant of the city? Is it just weekend meals? Mm-hmm. And really understanding these price points are lower, but you can get more in scale. I think that is the question. We just can't make the assumption that every small vendor should be in the institutional market share. Because we want every vendor to really grow and succeed and be able to succeed at a pace that they can keep up with.
Absolutely. And I bring this up quite a bit with small businesses, this time-space continuum that a small business owner is operating very much on a month-by-month cash flow basis. And institutions are operating on years of time spans. I mean, the contracts you go into are between 3 to 5 to 10 years even. And so the pace in which business is done is very different. And just knowing those expectations, even not just pace of business development, but even in terms of business transactionally, working with an institution may mean net 45 or net 60 or net 90 payment. And are you as a small business owner ready for that? So I thank you for bringing up that point. It's really, really important because it seems like a grand opportunity, but you have to be ready for that stage of growth in order to meet that demand. And it's not always because of price point.
Right.
It's because of all of these other logistics. Thank you so much, Holly, for being with us on The Tidbit. How can people find out about you and your work?
So you can definitely go to our website is the best place. Mm-hmm. In all honesty, I just Google it because it's a really long website. So the Baltimore Food Policy Initiative Department of Planning website.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much. Well, listeners, we hope that you tune in every week. And if you have any suggestions on topics that you would like to hear, please head over to curate.co, C-U-R-E-A-T-E.co, and let us know. Say hello. We're always eager to hear your thoughts and feedback. And until next time, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.